In 1914, Gurdit Singh, a Sikh entrepreneur based in Singapore, chartered a Japanese ship, the Komagatu Maru, to carry Indian immigrants to Canada. On May 23, 1914, the ship arrived in Vancouver Harbor with 376 passengers aboard, 340 Sikhs, 24 Muslims, and 12 Hindus. Many of the men on board were veterans of the British Indian Army and believed that it was their right as British subjects to settle anywhere in the empire they had fought to defend and expand. Continuous Journey is a film and is an inquiry into the largely ignored history of Canada's exclusion of the South Asians by a little-known immigration policy called the Continuous Journey Regulation of 1908. Joining us on the line from Toronto, from his home, is Ali Kazmi, the maker of this film. Good morning, Ali.
Hi.
I wanted to first start off by asking you about the Continuous Journey Regulation that the Canadian government had imposed. Could you tell us a bit about this policy?
Canada, as you know, had discriminatory regulations against the Chinese. It had the Chinese head tax. And to control the Japanese immigration, Canada had a secret agreement with Japan that said that only 400 people would be allowed into Canada every year. But with India, the issue was quite different. And this, I'm talking about British India, which we now call South Asia, because British India was very much part of the empire, as was Canada. And Canadian foreign policy at the time was directed by London. Now, you know, the imperial authorities told Canada not to pass a regulation that was openly discriminatory against Indians. So what Mackenzie King did, he was a young labor minister at that point, deputy minister, and he came up with this regulation which was considered to be brilliant. Basically, it said that you had to come by continuous journey from your country of birth or citizenship, or birth or nationality, to be accepted as an immigrant to Canada. Now, it didn't mention race or nationality, so it's a very neutral regulation. And at the same time, the Canadian government forced Canadian Pacific, which was running a very lucrative shipping line between Calcutta and Vancouver, to stop selling tickets to Indians first. And then secondly, they finally forced Canadian Pacific to stop that shipping line altogether. So you had to come by continuous journey, but there was no way of making that continuous journey from India any longer. And it was perfect. So the immigration from India dropped steeply after 1908.
Let's focus in on the Komagatu Maru.
Yeah.
It was only half a mile from Canadian shores when it was surrounded by immigration boats.
Right.
Could you tell us a bit about some of the events that happened from that point onward?
Well, first of all, the event itself of, you know, this is kind of like grand political theater in some ways, because here is, the ship is allowed to enter Canadian waters, but it stopped just offshore. And it's a very powerful sort of visual statement that the Canadian government was making, that you can enter, but then getting to land is going to be a completely different story. There was a community, there was an Indian community of about 2,500 strong on shore at the time in Vancouver, and they basically rallied to raise several thousand dollars to take over the charter of the ship. The ship had been chartered. What the Canadian government was doing was to delaying processing the passengers so that the charter would run out and the ship would be called back by its Japanese owners in mid-June. And the ship had arrived on May 23rd. So in a way, it would look like it was not the Canadian government that turned the ship away, but it would be the Japanese who automatically would pull the ship out. But what the Indian community on shore did was they raised $15,000 to take over the charter. Now, that would be like raising $500,000 today in a matter of 2 weeks from a community whose members earned less than a dollar a day. They take over the charter of the ship, and now the government is forced to go to the courts, which it's been avoiding. Of course, the one man is selected from the shipload of passengers. And it's a bit of a farce because the lawyer that community, the shore committee, hires, not allowed to board the ship. He's forced to select test case for the courts from a passenger list. He does his best. They go to court. Court basically rules against the passengers, because the question before the court was, could Canada discriminate against fellow British subject? Now, this had never been discussed in the courts before, but courts decided absolutely that Canada could discriminate against fellow British subjects, and that as good imperial subjects, Indians should choose to remain in their home country and work towards the betterment of the empire.
How were the people on board treated during this time?
During this time, people were starved. The immigration authorities tried their best to break their morale. They were denied food and water. They were threatened with attack. They were not allowed to even signal to their friends and compatriots on shore. And then once the test case was lost, the immigration authority tried to attack the boat with over 150 armed policemen and were beaten back by coal and other handy objects thrown by the passengers at the police. And at that point, the Canadian government then finally called out a Canadian warship, the HMCS Rainbow, and mobilized 350 people, a fully armed militia, to attack the ship.
And how did the standoff finally come to an end?
The standoff came to an end when the federal government agreed on with the kinds of provisions that would be required to feed the passengers for going back to India, which was another six-week voyage. And the community on shore was promised that they would be reimbursed for the $25,000 that they had spent on food for the passengers and for the legal case that they had mounted, but which never came to pass. The federal government never did give them the money back. There was a sham of an inquiry again, which basically said that these people had not done what they did. Once the ship returned to India 6 weeks later, then the final blow in the story was that there was a massacre by British troops firing at the passengers once they landed, and close to 60 people were killed.
Could you describe whether you feel that this incident was some sort of a turning point in the freedom struggle in British India, in India?
Absolutely. I mean, this was a turning point. It came at a very critical time. It came at a time when the First World War had started. Over a million Indian troops had been mobilized, had volunteered to go and fight for the empire in Europe. And, Indian nationalism was just beginning to grow. And what most of the nationalist leaders were asking for was essentially home rule and dominion status like Canada. Gandhi had returned to India almost at the same time, and he too considered himself a loyal British subject and was not looking at outright Indian independence. The so-called Komagaramaru incident completely blew the mythology apart that all British subjects were equal and all of them had the right to move across the empire, and that the empire was one big happy family. It just happened to be that it was British. In Punjab in particular, which was the main recruiting base of the Indian Army, there was a tremendous amount of hurt, anger, and hatred, for lack of a better word, against the British that started to grow. And the Sikhs, who had been loyal to the British till that point, started turning their backs towards the British and joining the freedom movement.
Now, you mentioned that upon return to India, there was about 60 deaths that happened, killings that happened. How were the passengers on the boat taken up by, for example, media? How was this issue represented, and what was the larger feeling within the country?
So that's a good question, and I think it makes us reflect on what's happening today. When the press in India, given that India was at war, during the First World War, there was press censorship, and the British essentially presented the sequence of events as a riot, and most nationalist leaders at the time agreed and concurred with the British that this was a riot. But word got out to the Punjab, and there it was, and in Bengal, where the massacre happened, there, for most people in the know, it was clearly seen as a massacre. You know, it all depends on how we look at these kinds of events and how we label them, and what it depends on the position we see them from. If we're in the heart of the empire, we see it as a riot. If we are in the freedom movement, we see it as a massacre.
I wanted to ask, as a filmmaker, what your inspiration was to take up this topic and make a film about it.
I had been intrigued by the absolute power that immigration officers have. And this comes from my first-hand experience in dealing with immigration officers 20 years ago. and I came as a film student, and having to deal with them every year to renew my visa, I was struck by the power given to immigration officers by the Immigration Act, which is quite absolute. But also, I didn't know about the history of early Indian immigration to Canada. And the more that I read, the more excited I became. And at the same time, I realized that most people from South Asia who'd come to Canada did not know this history. And certainly most second-generation people did not know this history. And the more people told me that they didn't know, I felt it was more and more important to make this film.
Since 9/11, there's been a very real crackdown and marginalization of a lot of immigrants, particularly from South Asia and the Middle East, those people who have been racialized and put into the category of terrorists, quote unquote. What do you think of the climate right now and how it compares to what was happening at the turn of the century?
Well, one of the biggest similarities, I think, is the ways that immigration exclusions are being masked by similar, seemingly neutral regulations in the Immigration Act. For example, we now have the Safe Third Country Agreement between Canada and the U.S., which again offers a very innocuous, neutral-sounding regulation, which says that to come as a refugee to Canada, the refugees must come directly from their own country. If they happen to come via the United States, they cannot enter Canada, and they will have to seek asylum in the U.S. Now, we all know that the state of the U.S. Immigration situation these days, but knowing that, Canada still initiated this agreement, which in effect is going to lead to, it's estimated, to a drop of about 30 to 35% of refugee applicants to Canada, since many people come via the United States. Yet at the same time, Canada sees itself at the vanguard of defending human rights, of promoting human rights, and a more compassionate and tolerant world on the international stage. So I see the Safe Third Country Agreement mirroring the Continuous Journey Regulation. And what's interesting about the Continuous Journey Regulation is that, you know, even most historians, most Canadian nationalist historians, do not even consider that regulation to be part of Canada's exclusions. You know, people do talk about the Chinese head tax and the Japanese internment because they have to, but the Continuous Journey Regulation, in a sense, flies completely below their radar. And that's the power of passing these neutral regulations which completely win over not just the public opinion at the time, but, you know, are effectively get buried, and their legacy gets buried by subsequent generations. So I see direct links between what's happening, and also it's a very different, it's a kind of a similar imperial context. I just feel the center of the empire has shifted from London to Washington.
One last question about the reception that this film has gotten when you have screened it. Have people been making these links? Have people been reconnecting back to the history?
Absolutely. I mean, I recently screened the film at the San Francisco International Asian American Festival, and it's the oldest Asian American festival. This is the 25th year. And this was the first time I'd screened the film outside Canada. And I was completely moved by the response. People got the film, you know, in the Q&As, people would get up, and I was repeatedly told that I had made a film about what's happening in the U.S. right now. Everybody made the links, I was overwhelmed at the end because the film did win the Audience Award for Best Feature Documentary, and in Canada, it's been, of course, I mean, people can make the links all the time, and they see the direct connection between it. Which is very, very gratifying because the film took me 8 years to make, and I was repeatedly told by potential funders and broadcasters, A, that this was an impossible film, B, that no one would watch it because it was such a dark chapter in Canadian history and we had to look on the bright side of life.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Samira, for having me.
We were joined on the line by Ali Kazmi, who is the maker of Continuous Journey.